And so could I spare a copy of a Bridgemental text here? Does anyone interested in this one? I've been looking at this one. It's done by a British monk, Pesala, who did that a few years ago. And it's really just a kind of a popular summary of the text. I've got the same one here, but I'm using this as a mouse pad so you can't have it. And it's not huge. It's okay as a kind of an introductory, readable introductory text, but it's not hugely accurate. This one here is I.B. Horner, which is the best edition of the text, translated by her, first published 1963. So that will be the best English translation if you want to research the thing properly. We do have... this is another abridgment, yeah. Mendes's abridgment, yeah. So probably, I'm not familiar with that one, but I imagine similar.
It's got an introduction
by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Okay. Well, if it's got anything by Bhikkhu Bodhi, then it must be good. So, look, I'm sure both of those ones are fine, but they're just not as precise, that's all. But we do also have there's also an earlier complete translation by Rhys Davids, done much earlier than I.B. Horner's version, and that's available online at the sacredtexts.com, which is a, if you're not familiar with it, sacredtexts.com is an excellent website with all kinds of interesting things on it. It sort of specializes in out-of-copyright translations and things like that. Now, the Questions of King Melinda, as we've said before, is the most interesting as the interaction between Western, or especially Greek, person and the and Buddhism and Indian philosophy. And for those of you, because we refer to Greek philosophers quite often, and for those of you who are not familiar or haven't read, then I thoroughly recommend this book. This is Plato's The Last Day of Last Days of Socrates. Is a collection of about only three or four shortish dialogues of Plato, mainly around the time of his death. And I really do strongly recommend that. It's a very moving account of the death of Socrates and the things that happened around that time. And it gives you a very good idea of the directions that that Greek philosophy was going in, and particularly how it applied in quite a relevant way to, you know, the immediate questions of life and death. So do yourself a favour, and anyone who is interested to really look at it in detail, The Shape of Ancient Thought, Thomas McEverley. It's 732 pages with a small font printed close to the edges of the page with lots and lots of footnotes. And so anybody who really wants to get into the meaty stuff, this is probably the most detailed study ever done of the interaction between Greek and Indian philosophy and so on. So on the picture, you can see it's got a very lovely picture on the cover. You can see this Greek column, like the detail of the decorations on a typical Greek column with kind of vines and so on. And then nestled away in there is a Buddha image in the Greek column there in the corner. That's quite cute. Okay. So unfortunately, we can't go over all of these things right now, so we'll come back to the Melinda Panha. So just the basic information up front from Wikipedia. Melinda Panha is a Buddhist text which dates from approximately 100 BCE. That's a dubious dating, nevertheless. It's included in the Burmese edition of the Pali Canon of Theravada Buddhism as a book of the Kuddhika Nikaya. However, it does not appear in the Thai or Sri Lankan versions. So this is one of a series of books which are quasi-canonical. sometimes perhaps called paracanonical, and the Burmese always have more of a tendency to include later things in their canon as compared to the Sri Lankan and Thai, and the Neti Pikarana and Petakopadesa are usually the other two books that are included by the Burmese and not by the others. Most of the standard editions now are moving towards sort of comprehensiveness, so the online editions of the Pali Canon typically do include all of these books following the line of the Burmese. The Burmese canon sort of took precedence at the Sixth Council in mid-20th century, and so since that time that's become more and more the standard. But it's worth remembering that that wasn't the case up until quite recently. The Anandapanha purports to record a dialogue in which the Indo-Greek king Mananda I of Bactria, who reigned in the 2nd century BCE, poses questions on Buddhism to the sage Nagasena. Okay, so notice the dating here. Mananda is supposed to reign 2nd century BCE. The date here is approximately 100 BCE. In other words, tradition, this is more or less a traditional claim, is that it was compiled, you know, literally in Mananda's life or shortly afterwards. The earliest part of the text is believed to have been written between 100 BCE and 200 CE. The text may have initially been written in Sanskrit. However, apart from the original was likely to have been written in Sanskrit. However, apart from the Sri Lankan Pali edition and derivatives, no other copies are known. I'm not quite sure what that means. It's available in Chinese translations. It's generally accepted by scholars that the work is composite with additions made over time. In support of this, it's noted that the Chinese versions of the work are substantially shorter. Okay, so the Pali version in this case is longer and has been subjected to more elaboration as compared to the Chinese. So, I mean, that was very important to bear in mind that the Pali tradition is not always the most authentic. Nevertheless, of course, it's still of great interest because it's the only one remaining in the Indian language. The oldest Pali manuscript was copied in 1495 CE, which is interesting. That's quite early for a Pali manuscript. Based on references within the text itself, significant sections of the text are lost, making Milindapanha the only Pali text known to have been passed down as incomplete. The books included in the inscriptions of the canon approved by the Burmese Fifth Council and the printed edition of the Sixth Council text. Rhys David said that it's the greatest work of classical Indian prose, although Moritz Winternitz says this is true only of the earlier parts. And so just some background information on Mananda. So there's one of his coins, which is quite a nice image there, isn't it? Amazing how little coins have changed over the years. We still have the head of our Queen, Australian coin. He has indeed got a very proud and straight nose, yes? Yes. Saviour, Soteros, the Saviour, King Mananda. The ruler of the Indo-Greek kingdom in present-day Pakistan from either 165 or 155 BC to 130 BC. Territories covered the eastern dominions of the divided Greek Empire of Bactria and extended to the modern Pakistani provinces of blah, blah, blah. His capital is supposed to have been Sargala, a prosperous city in northern Punjab. He is one of the few Bactrian kings mentioned by Greek authors, among them Apollodorus of Artemita, quoted by Strabo, who claims that the Greeks from Bactria were even greater conquerors than Alexander the Great. And that Mananda was one of two Bactrian kings with Demetrius who extended their power furthest into India. And so here's the quote from Strabo. The Greeks who caused Bactria to revolt grew so powerful on account of the fertility of the country that they became masters not only of Ariana but also of India, as Apollodorus of Artemita says. And more tribes were subdued by them than by Alexander, by Mananda in particular. At least, if he actually crossed the Hapanis towards the east and advanced as far as the Emmaus, I'm not sure how that's supposed to be pronounced, for some were subdued by him personally and others by Demetrius, the son of Euthydemus, the king of the Bactrians, and they took possession not only of Patalena but also on the rest of the coast of what is called the kingdom of Sarostus and Sigirdus, In short, Apollodorus says that Bhaktivedanta is the ornament of Arjuna as a whole, and more than that, they extended their empire even as far as the Saris and the Phryne. So this is quite interesting that you get these two different perspectives. You know, from the Buddhist perspective, you've got a peaceful king who's engaged in a Buddhist dialogue with a monk. And from the Greek perspective, they say, whoopee, you know, he was so great because he conquered all of these countries and subdued all of these tribes. So not entirely dissimilar to King Ashoka. And those who came after Alexander went to the Ganges and Pataliputra, so suggesting that the Greek conquests went as far as Pataliputra, modern-day Patna, the heart of the Magadhan kingdom. The Indian records also... So this is Athena on the right here, thunderbolt and shield. The Indian records also describe Greek attacks on Mathura, Panchala, Saketa and Pataliputra. Mentions of invasion by Patanjali in 150 BC and the Yuga Purana, which describe Indian historical events in the form of a prophecy. After conquering Saketa, the country of the Panchala and the Mataras, the Yavanas, the Greeks, wicked and valiant, will reach Kusuma Dwaja, the thick mud fortifications of Pataliputra being reached, all the provinces will be in disorder without doubt. Ultimately, a great battle will follow with tree-like engines, siege engines. Interesting. The fortifications at Pataliputra are indeed very thick. If you ever go there, they've uncovered some of the walls around there. They're made of these massive trees, pole trees, sort of packed with mud and so on. In I don't know how thick they are, I can't remember, but they're several meters thick anyway. Mananda seems to have repelled the invasion of the dynasty of the Greco-Bactrian usurper Eucratides, consolidating the rule of the Indo-Greek kings. And so here's a quote from the Melinda Panha, which suggests his military methods. Has it ever happened to you, O king, that rival kings rose up against you as enemies and opponents? Yes, certainly. Then you set to work, I suppose, to have moats dug and ramparts thrown up, and watchtowers erected, and strongholds built, and stores of food collected, which the king says not at all. All that had been prepared beforehand. He said, well, did you have yourself trained in the management of war elephants, and in horsemanship, and the use of the war chariot, and archery, and fencing? Not at all. I had learned all that before. But why? With the object of warding off future danger. Okay, so obviously a question about being prepared. His reign was long and successful. Generous findings of coins testify to the prosperity and extension of his empire, with finds as far as Britain. The finds of his coins are the most numerous and most widespread of all the Indo-Greek kings. Precise dates of his reign as well as his origin remain elusive, however. Guesses among historians have been that Mananda was either the nephew or former general of the Greco-Bactrian king Demetrius I, but the two kings are now thought to be separated by at least 30 years. Mananda's predecessor in Punjab seems to have been the king Apollodotus I. Mananda's empire survived him in a fragmented manner until the last Greek king Strato II disappeared around 10 AD. Mananda was the first Indo-Greek ruler to introduce the representation of Athena Alcidemos, Athena saver of the people, on his coins, probably in reference to a similar statue of Athena Alcidemos in Pella, capital of Macedon. This type was subsequently used by most of the later Indo-Greek kings. According to tradition, Mananda embraced the Buddhist faith, described as constantly accompanied by a guard of about 500 Greek Yonica soldiers, and two of his counselors are named Demetrius and Antiochus. This type of discussion was known to ancient Greeks as a sozo. Okay, so here's one of the, I think we saw this before, this is the Dhamma wheel and one of his coins. In the Melinda Panha itself it says, King Mananda describes Mananda as the king of the city of Sagala in India, Melinda by name, learned, eloquent, wise and able, and a faithful observer, and that at the right time of all the various acts of devotion and ceremony enjoined by his own sacred hymns concerning things past, present and to come. Many were the arts and sciences he knew, holy tradition and secular law, the Sankhya, Yoga, Nyaya and Vaisheshika, systems of philosophy, arithmetic, music, medicine, so on and so forth. As a disputant, he was hard to equal, harder still to overcome, the acknowledged superior of all the founders of the various schools of thought. As in wisdom, so in strength of body, swiftness and valour, there was found none equal to Milinda in all India. He was rich too, mighty in wealth and prosperity, and the number of his armed hosts knew no end. So, according to the tradition, he became a dedicated Buddhist, and then at the end, handed over his kingdom to his son, abandoned household life for the house of state, grew great in insight, and attained to arahantship. So that's doubted by the historians. So this is a depiction of an Indo-Greek king, and possibly Mananda. Okay, so we won't go into too much more detail about King Mananda's, and then there's Mananda the Second, was he called in confusion, and someone. But this is probably has some significance is the heritage or the legacy. After the reign of Mananda the First, several subsequent Indo-Greek rulers depicted themselves or their Greek deities forming with the right hand a symbolic gesture identical to the Buddhist Vitarka mudra, thumb and index joined together with the other fingers extended. So the Vitarka mudra is the teaching mudra we see on Buddha images very commonly, especially the teaching the first sermon. So it's very interesting, isn't it? There's these Vitarka mudra very found in all these Indo-Greek deities, kings and deities. At the same, so that signifies the transmission of the Buddha's teachings. So that's very significant because it suggests that not only were they Buddhists, but that they were actually, I mean, that's specifically the symbol for spreading the teaching. At the same time, right after the death of Mananda, several Indo-Greek rulers also started to adopt on their coins the Pali title of Dharmikasa, not quite Pali, but anyway, meaning follower of the Dharma. This usage was adopted by various kings. Altogether, the conversion of Mananda to Buddhism suggested by the Milinda Banha seems to have triggered the use of Buddhist symbolism in one form or another on the coinage of close to half the kings who succeeded him, especially the kings after Mananda who are recorded to have ruled in Gandhara, display the Buddhist symbolism in one form or another. Because of this conversion, because of his unequal territorial expansion, Mananda may have contributed to the expansion of Buddhism in Central Asia through the spread of Buddhism to Central Asia and Northern Asia. Although it's usually associated with the Kushans a century or two later, there's a possibility that it may have been introduced in those areas from Gandhara even earlier, during the time of Demetrius and Mananda. In fact, I think it's almost inevitable that it would have been gradually growing during that whole period, if not sort of introduced in the sense of having actual monasteries and so on. Okay, so I want to talk a bit more about the text of the book. But before we spend too much time talking about these various kinds of background material, we should really plunge into the book as such. Now, the beginning of the Milinda Banha begins with quite a long introductory narrative, which gives the background to how to Nagasena and the monk Nagasena and Milinda and how they came to meet and have this dialogue and so on. I won't go too much into that as it's interesting in its own right, but the actual questions are more important. But just to note one obvious detail here in the Adi Horner's translation on page 6. It talks about how King Milinda is told about and goes to meet the six teachers, Purana Kasapa, Makkali Gosala, Nataputta, Sanjaya Velataputta, Majjhitakesa Kambala, and Pakadoka Chayana. And of course these are the same six heretical teachers that we found in the Samanipala Sutta. Right? So that they were alive in the day of the Buddha, so now here we are 400 years later, and King Milinda is going off to meet the same six monks. So now we have two choices here. One, these monks found the secret to eternal life. Or two, the text is not only inaccurate, but so shamelessly and obviously inaccurate that the compilers and the people reading it couldn't pick up some obvious anachronism like that, which I find quite extraordinary in a sense.
Reading this
one, thought
that it's very similar to
that. It's the Manipala Sutta. Obviously modelled after it, yeah.
I mean, the fear of
the fear. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the
sitting in the pavilions
surrounded by the
monks. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It's clearly been it's modelled quite closely on the Samanyapala Sutta, a little bit too closely, perhaps. It's an interesting sort of evidence for the influential nature of the Samanyapala Sutta, but also gives some insight into the way that Buddhist texts were formed, and especially the literary features of them. One other little historical detail just to mention in passing, when Nagasena is looking for a teacher, he's told to go to Pataliputta and to meet the Venerable Dhammarakkhita, who's living in the Ashoka Monastery in the town of Pataliputta. And so this Dhammarakkhita is elsewhere called the Yonika Dhammarakkhita, the Greek Dhammarakkhita. And I think he's probably the founder of the Dharmaguptaka school. And again, it's a little bit anachronistic here because he was supposed to be alive in the time of King Ashoka, but perhaps not as anachronistic. And there's a bit of wiggle room there. So Nagasena was supposed to have had a Greek monk as his teacher. Now, I'll come back to discussing the relationships between the text and so on in a little bit later, but we might just start out with the first question. Okay, now I have in front of me I.B. Horner's translation, which is probably the most accurate one, so I'll try to refer to that as much as I can. But on the screen there you have he's pretty venerable, Rhys Davids' translation, which is the older one, probably slightly less accurate. And King Melinda approached Venerable Nagasena, exchanged greetings, and sat down. And then he asked him, "How is the Venerable One known?" He said, "I'm called Nagasena. But though my parents gave me the name of Nagasena or Surasena or Virasena or Sihasena," curious kind of way of putting it, "they give such a name as Nagasena, Surasena, Virasena or Sihasena, yet it is but a denotation, an appellation, a designation, a current usage, for Nagasena is only a name since there is no person here." Okay, so Nagasena obviously giving the king a kind of puzzle in his answer. King Melinda spoke thus, "Good sirs," so speaking to let the 500 Bactrian Greeks and the 80,000 monks present, 80,000, right, "hear me. This Nagasena speaks thus, since no person is got at here. Now, is it suitable to approve of that?" And King Melinda spoke thus to the Venerable Nagasena, "If, Reverend Nagasena, the person is not got at, who then is it that gives you the requisites of robe material, alms food, lodgings, and medicines for the sick? Who is it that makes use of them? Who is it that guards moral habit, practices mental development, realizes the paths, the fruits, nibbana? Who is it that kills a living thing, takes what is not given, gives wrongly amid the sense pleasures, goes wrongly amid the sense pleasures, speaks lyingly, drinks toddy? And who commits the fivefold kama, the fruit of which comes with no delay?" These are the five, killing a mother, killing a father, and so on, and antarika kama. "Therefore there is no skill, there is no unskill, there is not one that does nor makes another do deeds that are skilled or unskilled, there is no fruit or ripening of deeds well or ill done." And so here he's echoing some of the doctrines of the six heretics. "If, Reverend Nagasena, someone killed you, there would be no onslaught on preachers for him. Also, Reverend Nagasena, you have no teacher, no preceptor, and no ordination. If you say, fellow livers of the holy life, address me, sire, as Nagasena, what here is Nagasena? Is it, reverend sir, that the hairs of the head are Nagasena? And he says, oh no, sire, that the hairs of the body are Nagasena. Certainly not. Or is it the nails, the teeth, the skin, the flesh, the nerves, the bone, and so on and so forth? Any of these is Nagasena. And to each of them, he said, no, sire. Is Nagasena material form, rupa? No. Is he feeling, perception, sankharas? Is he consciousness? No. And then is it all of these together? No, sire. But then, Reverend Sir, is there a Nagasena apart from Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana, the five aggregates? No, sire. Although I, Reverend Sir, am asking you repeatedly, I do not see this Nagasena. Nagasena is only a sound, Reverend Sir, for who here is Nagasena? You, Reverend Sir, are speaking an untruth, a lying word. There is no Nagasena. Then the Venerable Nagasena. So it's quite an energetic kind of debate, isn't it? You know, and they, you know, he's not afraid to contradict or anything like that. And it's also interesting that one of the great characteristics of this is that throughout it, Melinda is depicted as being entirely conversant with Buddhist doctrines. Okay, so we've seen all through those questions that Melinda has asked. It's all about the five precepts. It's about the four requisites of the bhikkhu. It's about the group of the five anantarika kamas, what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. There's the various parts of the body and the five khandhas. So it's entirely a list of very standard and well-known Buddhist doctrinal concepts. There's no reference at all to Greek philosophy. And so this is one of the characteristics of it, which is perhaps a little bit disappointing. But certainly he's at least regarded as being someone quite familiar with Buddhism. So it's an internal debate among Buddhists of Buddhist philosophy. So Nagasena replies, you, sire, a noble, delicately nurtured, if you were to walk this dry weather on the scorching ground and hot sand, trampling on sharp grit and pebbles and sand, your feet hurt you, your body wearies, your thought is impaired, and tactile consciousness arises accompanied by anguish. Now, did you come on foot or in a conveyance? Reverend Sir, I did not come on foot, I came in a chariot. If, sire, you came on a chariot, show me the chariot. Is the pole the chariot? Oh, no, Reverend Sir. Is the axle the chariot? Oh, no, Reverend Sir. Are the wheels the chariot? No, Reverend Sir. Is the body of the chariot, the flagstaff, is the yoke, are the reins, or is the goad the chariot? Oh, no, Reverend Sir. Then is it all these parts? No, Reverend Sir. But then is there a chariot apart from the pole, the axle, the wheels, the body of the chariot and these parts? No, Reverend Sir. Though I, Reverend Sir, am asking repeatedly, I do not see the chariot. The chariot is only a sound, sire. For what here is the chariot? You, sire, are speaking an untruth, a lying word. There is no chariot. You, sire, are the chief king in the whole of India. Who are you afraid of that you would speak a lie? Let the 500 worthy Bactrian Greeks and the 80,000 monks listen to me. King Melinda says, I've come by chariot, but I'm being told, if you come by chariot, show me a chariot. He does not produce the chariot. Who could approve of that? When he thus spoken, the 500 Greeks shouted their applause and said to the king, now let your majesty get out of that if he can. Then, so they're all having great fun here. You can imagine the king's attendants and so on being quite happy to see their king being humiliated in public. So they're all enjoying themselves thoroughly. Melinda the king replied to Nagasena and said, I, Reverend Nagasena, am not telling a lie, for it is because of the pole, the axle, the wheels, the body, the flagstaff, and the rest that the chariot, that the designation chariot exists, the appellation, the designation, the denotation as a current usage and as a name. Very good, Your Majesty, you understand a chariot. Even so, it is for me, sire, because of the hair of the head and so on, that Nagasena exists as a denotation, an appellation, a designation as a current usage merely as a name, but according to the highest usage, the Paramatta, the person is not got at here. This sigh was spoken by the Nambajira face to face with the Lord. Just as when the parts are rightly set, the word chariot is spoken, so when there are the Kanda, the five aggregates, it is the convention to say a being. It is wonderful, Reverend Nagasena. It is marvelous, Reverend Nagasena. The explanations of the questions that were asked are very brilliant. If the Buddha were still here, he would applaud. It is good. It is good, Nagasena. The explanations of the questions that were asked are very brilliant. Okay, so this is the first dialogue, very famous one, the dialogue of the chariot. And you can see at the end there that Nagasena, having won the debate, then caps off his victory by his canonical quote, and this of course is the verses of Bhikkhuni Vajira from the Bhikkhuni Samyutta. And interestingly enough that says that Vajira spoke these words face to face with the Buddha. In fact, in the text itself it says she spoke them face to face to Mara. Slight little variation there. Anyway, and so you get a very good idea of the character of the debate here. And before we go on, are there any questions about that or any comments on that particular dialogue? Is it right, by the way? Is his argument correct? Has Nagasena explained the Dhamma properly? Yeah, it is. It's very, very closely related. It's not. It's a little bit less. It's a little bit less sort of philosophically sophisticated than the teachings on emptiness that you find in like the Prajnaparamita or something. But similar. Certainly a similar kind of thing. Yeah, moving in the same direction. But I mean, the Prajnaparamita is really just a sort of very, very long meditation on not self, really.
This is
anatta. On anatta, yeah. And using that kind of analytical method, breaking things down, looking for the designation, and that insistence on the use of words as conventions rather than being absolutes or being sort of intrinsically bound up with things, which was what the Brahmanical belief was.
It's also at least an experience, the names of labels.
Move on and have a bit of a look at some of the other dialogue. But it's also interesting, I think it's interesting that the nature of the dialogue is a very common one, that people do ask these kinds of questions, and they must have been quite common in Buddhist history, and of course right down to the present day these are some of the most important questions asked about of Buddhists and so on. And the pitch of the Milinda Panha is very, I think, is very nice. Most of the books that we have in Buddhism are either extremely convoluted and difficult philosophical texts, or else they're very kind of simplistic sort of fairy tales and legends and so on. And the Milinda Panha is just about the only Buddhist text from this period, certainly about the only Pali text, which is intelligent and relevant and meaningful without being too abstract and complex. Okay, so the second set of questions. How many years of seniority do you have, Nagasena? 7, Your Majesty. But how can you say, what are these 7, Reverend Sir? It is you that are 7, or is it the reckoning that is 7? At that moment, the king's shadow, decked with all his ornaments, adorned and dressed, was to be seen on the ground and was to be seen in a water pot. The Venerable Nagasena spoke thus to King Milinda, "This shadow of yours, sire, is to be seen on the ground and in the water pot. But, sire, are you the king, or is the shadow the king?" I, reverend sir, am the king. This shadow is not the king, but it is owing to me that the shadow exists. Even so, sire, the reckoning of the years is seven. It is not that I am seven, but it is owing to me that seven exists, as in the simile does the shadow, sire. It is wonderful, Reverend Lagasena. It is marvellous. The explanations are very good. Okay. And then this next part of the dialogue I like quite good, like quite well. Lagasena, would you converse with me? I will converse, if you sire, will converse in the speech of the learned, as do the sages, the scholars, the pundits. But if you converse in the speech of kings, I will not converse. How, Reverend Lagasena, do the learned converse? When the learned are conversing, sire, a turning over of a subject is made, and an unravelling is made, and a refutation is made, and a redress is made, and a specific point is made, and a specific point is made against it, and the learned are not angry in consequence. It is thus, sire, that the learned converse. And how do kings converse, reverend sir? When kings are conversing, sire, they approve of some matter and order a punishment for whoever disagrees with that matter, saying, inflict a punishment on him. It is thus, sire, that kings converse. And some things never change, do they? I, reverend sir, will converse in the speech of the learned, not as in the speech of kings. Let the reverend one converse unreservedly as he converses with a monk or novice or lay follower or with a monastery attendant. Let the reverend one converse thus. Let him be not afraid. And he said, it is well, sire. So, and this is, again, a very good dialogue and a good reminder for us all that this is, according to Nagasena, this is the way that learned people, that scholars and so on, should discuss by arguing or discussing and criticizing each other's views and so on when necessary, but without giving rise to anger as a result of that. Okay, so then they have a little bit more discussion, but the king says that he's going to go and have some discussion in the palace tomorrow. So they don't have any more discussion that day. Okay. So that's the first encounter between the two, and giving some idea of what's to follow. I won't go into all the narrative there, but I'll just give a little bit of background here onto some of the other versions of the text. There's quite a nice detailed comparative study done by Bhikshu Thich Minh Chao, who's a Vietnamese bhikkhu. And Thich Minh Chao was probably one of the greatest scholars in modern Vietnamese Sangha. And he lived and studied for many years at Nalanda University in India. And it was where he wrote this study, relying both on the Milindapanha in Pali and also the Nagasena Bhikshu Sutra, being the title of the Chinese translation. And Thich Minh Chao also did the comparative study of the Chinese Majjhima Agama with the Pali Majjhima Nikaya. He then went back to Vietnam, had a very interesting, colourful career there. He's still alive, actually. Ayad Dhammananda visited him just recently, but he's apparently in hospital and not really able to speak anymore. He goes in his very kind of has a very systematic way of approaching things, and goes through the text in some detail, comparing the Chinese and the Pali, and I'll just go through a few of the points which they mention to find some of the relevant differences. Okay. And so he's got the list of the scholarly work. Quite a lot of scholarly work has been done in this text, so it's very interesting in nature. Okay, so it talks about some of the similarities between them. These ones, as mentioned here, are similarities in terms of the background stories of Nagasena and Milinda, which I won't go into. We haven't read that background story, so it won't make a huge amount of sense, but in any case, there are quite a lot of similarities in background stories, but also, of course, some differences. Some of the differences are that The Chinese text comprises three books from the first without any headings, whereas this Pali text is divided into seven parts. The Chinese has only 69 dialogues, while the Pali adds 12 more dialogues to its own version. And then here it lists the extra dialogues which are added to the Pali. The order of the dialogues is identical except in two instances. The previous lives of Nagasena and Melinda are totally different in both versions, as testified by the following divergences. So again, we won't go into that, but just to show that, as might be expected, while the story of their encounter in this life is relatively similar, being quite possibly based on a genuine historical encounter, the accounts of past lives are completely different. So the reference to the six heretical teachers and conversation of King Melinda with Purana Kassapa and Makkali Gosala, as we just mentioned, being derived from the Samanyapala Sutta, of course being quite historically impossible, is not found in the Chinese version. So that's in a sense, that's fairly obvious, and that's what you'd expect. And we don't need to, in this case, we don't need to refer to the Chinese version to be able to know that that particular episode was impossible. It's obvious immediately on reading it that it was an invention. But the fact that it's not in the Chinese text, in this case, it doesn't help us to verify the text, because we already know that it would have been inauthentic, but it helps to verify the method. Because we from the Pali text alone, we'd inferred that this passage must be a late one, and then when we refer to the Chinese text, that confirms that it's absent from the Chinese text. So what that kind of confirmation does is it shows us that this method of comparing the Pali and Chinese is actually meaningful and can help us to reconstruct or to infer meaningful things about the original text. Another interesting difference is that five times the Pali mentions the Abhidhamma. Okay, Nagasena is said to be an expert in the Abhidhamma. Rohana taught Nagasena seven books of the Abhidhamma, of course being the Pali books. Thirdly, Nagasena recited to the company of Arahants, and so on and so forth. That those are not found in the Chinese. There's no mention of Abhidhamma in the Chinese. Missing, and there's various things found in the Chinese that are missing in the Pali. So there's various other minor differences. Okay, so some of the doctrinal differences, that's more important. As I mentioned, not even once is the Abhidhamma mentioned in the Chinese, and not only just the Abhidhamma in general, but the specific Abhidhamma type doctrines. The seven sabba citta sadharana cetasika, seven mental factors which are present in all states of consciousness, which are passa, contact, feeling, perception, intention, one-pointedness, life faculty, and attention. These can only be found only in the Pali Abhidhamma, as other sects do not accept jivitindriya as classified as present in all moments of consciousness. So in other words, here we have a specific influence of the Pali Abhidhamma. The Chinese has the 37 factors of enlightenment, which are almost the same as the usual Pali ones, but some of them are different. The four Satipatthanas are almost the same. The four Sammapadanas, right efforts, the Chinese translates as the four eradications of the mind. This is an important thing to note, because in the Pali Padana, meaning effort, is very similar to the word Pahana, meaning abandon. And this is regularly confused in the many of the northern traditions. So they talk about the four abandonings, or the four eradications, rather than the four right efforts. And in fact, only one of the right efforts is an effort to eradicate, which is the effort to eradicate unwholesome dhammas from the mind, where you can use that eradication, but in other cases it doesn't apply. So it's a linguistic confusion from the Indian dialect. And then there's some rather curious definitions of these Bodhipakya Dhammas found in the Chinese text. For example, the four Iddhipadas, it says, the eyes can see everything, the ears can hear everything, the mind knows other minds, and the body can fly. It's kind of weird, isn't it? So it's a list of various kinds of psychic powers rather than the four Iddhipadas as such. And the five faculties, the five indriyas, are defined as not attached to the mind, to good and bad shapes, sounds, odors, tastes, and touches. And the powers are control of the eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and body. So here it's interpreting the indriyas, the faculties, as the sense faculties, rather than the spiritual faculties of faith, energy, and so on. So this is very curious, and the fact that the Chinese text has made such serious mistakes in the basic doctrines is, I think, quite unusual and quite raises some interesting questions. It's certainly not the case that the northern traditions in general make these errors, because in the Agama Sutras you find these things defined exactly as they are in the Pali. But for some reason the text has got these mixed up. Dependent origination also has some differences, in classifying of the kinds of Vedana. So some of the other minor differences in the doctrines. No, this is the Chinese text of the Nagasena Bhikshu. It's called the Nagasena Bhikshu Sutra, which the Chinese is here, Na Sien Pi Chu Ching. It's here. I'll show you the Chinese. I can show you the Chinese spelling of it. Here we go. Here, there's the Chinese spelling. So it's here. It's in the Taisho Canon. So just to come in Charles' discussion of the school of sect to which the Pali and Chinese versions belong, it is crystal clear that the Pali text belongs to the Theravadan school, which adopts Pali as its language. The quotation of the seven Abhidhamma books, the reference to the seven Chitta Sadhaharana Jetasikas, the stereotyped formula of the Patichasamapada speak out clearly that Milindapanha belongs to the Theravadan school. But it is difficult to guess the probable sect of the Chinese text, as there is absolutely no evidences to help us detect what sect it was likely to belong to. All the proofs above show that the Chinese original was compiled at a time when the growth of the Abhidhamma had not yet matured, and that the classification of the Buddha Dharma into Agama or Nikaya was not yet widely adopted. Okay. With the comparative study of the two versions done above, we can probe into the anteriority and fidelity of each version. And basically, he's following. Rhys Davies had the opinion that the Pali text was earlier than the Chinese original, as Rhys Davies was typically a sort of a proponent of the Pali scriptures. Following Levy and then Thich Nhat Hanh agrees that the Chinese was likely to be earlier than the Pali, and the reasons here, given some of which we've already seen, the anachronisms in the Pali text, the introduction of the six teachers, the Pali references to Abhidhamma, the Pali references to Dvipitika and Nikaya, the Chinese doctrinal formulas are not yet solidified, the Chinese text form prior to the formation of schools and sects, genuineness, Chinese version, whatever that means, the abundance of miracles in the Pali version, the moderation of the Chinese version, the addition of the last four books to the Pali version, divergences between the Roman and Siamese editions, divergences between Buddhaghosa's quotations and the readings of Milindapanha, and the conclusion that the Pali text is just an enlarged translation of the Chinese. Okay. Not an enlarged translation of the Chinese, an enlarged translation of the original on which the Chinese is based, which, as I said before, is likely to be in Sanskrit. The text uses a particular Sanskrit formula, whereas in Pali you always have the formula evam me sutam. In Sanskrit you have a similar formula evam maya anusrutam. The Milindapanha is the only Pali text that actually uses that Sanskrit formula. It's likely that it was, the original was in Sanskrit. So again, I won't go into all these details, but anyone who's interested to follow this up can get this text from me if they're interested. So I'll just see if there's any specific comments here on the the dialogue that we just discussed.
Does that indicate that the Theravada that they just liked it more and used it a lot more, therefore they embellished it and added it.
Could well be, yeah. Could well be, yeah. Which could be for any number of reasons. One thing that he remarks, which is interesting, is that the first discussion, which we've just seen, is the basically discussion on the question of self and not self. Is there a person called Nagasena? And that's also the first question in the Katawatu, is the Abhidhamma sort of collection of Abhidhamma controversies. We've got a long section on the question of not self. So it seems that was kind of very important, particularly for the Pali school. So that may have influenced things as well.
Was that also of importance in this doctrine of, is it Book of the Writer?
Yeah.
That was also fundamental to that
debate? Yeah.
Sometime around then.
Yeah, it's a similar time period. That's right. It seems that the author of the Katawatu actually got into arguments with the Pugalavadins. That was the main sort of doctrinal opposition at that time. Yeah.
And was that around the same time as this?
Hard to say. Roughly the same or a bit earlier. Yeah. But in a similar way, the Chinese version of the Katawatu is also shorter and probably more authentic than the Pali version. It's found in a Sarvastivadin Abhidhamma book called the Vijñānakāya. Okay. So here it just goes into the details of some of the questions, basically similar kind of dialogue differences in detail. Let's see if there's any interesting detail. So the passage where Nagasena accused the king of speaking a falsehood was added in the Pali. So the next question where they ask about the 7 years of ordination is, and the 7 years of seniority is missing in the Chinese text, which seems again fairly reasonable to me because they've got this, obviously quite important discussion on the chariot and then the discussion about the ways of talking, debating as a king or as a sage, and this one about the years of seniority which the Pali puts in between there seems a little bit superfluous. So, being probably an exaggeration there.
That's not included in the
original. It's not in the Chinese, probably not original, yeah. So, again, I won't go into all the details here, but just that this resource is available for anyone who's interested to look at it. So I might just go back and have a look at some more of the questions in the Milindapanha itself, in the Pali text, and particularly if anybody's been reading it or had a look, if they've had any passages that they found interesting or got any questions about, maybe they could mention them and we could have a look at those ones. So of course there are a lot of interesting things here. So this is the the Nagasena discussing with Anantakaya about this one, I think one of the king's attendants, if I remember correctly, and a similar discussion which here is Nagasena, and he says this, whatever is this inner mobile principle, the inner breath, the life principle. So Nagasena says, what do you think Nagasena is? Right. So the attendant saying, what is that Nagasena? And the monk replies, what do you think Nagasena is? And he says, the soul or the inner breath which comes and goes. That, I think, is Nagasena. Okay, so here, whereas Melinda, notice that Melinda didn't fall back on a soul doctrine. Yeah, he wasn't involved with the soul doctrine, but he was involved in clarifying the nature of the Buddhist doctrines. But here the attendant actually introduces the notion of a soul. If this breath has, having issued forth, does not return again, or has entered but not issued forth again, would that man lived? Okay, so here, it's clear from this discussion that when he's using the words he's using for the breath here, or the soul, is the vaya, is literally the air, or the vata, the wind. So it's quite, or the jiva. So he's meaning quite literally the breath in a physical sense, and he's identifying the self with the breath. So if the breath wasn't moving anymore, then would the man be alive? Certainly not, sir. Then he said, but those trumpeters, or he says conch blowers here, and they blow on a trumpet, does the breath return to them again? No, sir, it does not. Or those pipers, when they blow on a bamboo pipe, does the breath return to them? No, sir, then why do they not die? And he says, I'm not capable of arguing with such a reasoner. Pray tell me, sir, how the matter stands. And Nagasena says, this is not the soul. In breathing and out-breathing are merely bodily activities, kaya sankhara. And the elder gave a talk on Abhidhamma to such an effect that another kaya made himself a supporter.
Is this question number four?
It is question number four, yeah.
Maybe not.
Okay, well, the question is, they've been looking for a self. That was the original question. And the minister, Antakaya, says, well, he's basically holds a doctrine that the self is the breath, quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is obviously when you find in like the prana, or prana in Hinduism, or in Western thought, like the spirit. Of course, the spirit is originally the breath. So, and Nagasena is saying, well, what happened when you're a trumpet player and you breathe right out and your breath goes right out of your body? Have you lost your soul? Well, it's true, but that's just a more dramatic example. So he started with that ordinary case, but then he used a more dramatic example.
Yes, I understand why in the ordinary case, he's dead. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you go to the trumpet, then he's not dead. Yeah, it's just kind of... Why when it's presented in a way that you blow and then... Do they think that when you blow out, you take the same thing in again? Is that
something like that, yeah. It is. That's what he's showing. His idea is to show that these kinds of ideas are often unreflective. I mean, the idea that the breath is the soul is fairly... I mean, it's fairly intuitive in the sense that someone who's alive is breathing and someone who's dead is not. So it's not a kind of unreasonable position, but then he's just kind of trying to show, well, actually when you investigate it a bit, it's not really that coherent. Incidentally, I mean, I'd have to say that in medieval Europe, trumpeters had a very short lifespan. Because their breath went out and didn't come back. It's before they invented the valves on trumpets, and it was extremely difficult to blow them, yeah, so they...
But that should be the other way around. They should have developed really, really good lungs.
Ideally, yeah. Think of that when you listen to the Brandenburg Concerto. Sorry?
I seem to call it, I think, probably the last bit of a who, that I think can learn less in the word breath than...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's probably the root is the same as the English spirit, as in respiration.
Yeah.
And so it's the same in the
viva.
Yeah. It's the same in the Indic, the word prana is meaning breath.
Same.
Yeah. And chi in Chinese as well.
Breath and soul.
Yeah. So you can see here, this is an example of how these doctrines evolve, that you have these kind of fairly unreflective but understandable ideas, and then, kind of reflect on them. Okay, well, it can't really be literally the breath. And there's, of course, a lot of talk in the Upanishads and so on of how the breath is the soul. So then go on to some other things. Nagasena goes, has a nice meal. King Milinda offers the robes and so on. And he says, the king asks this question, what is the object of your going forth? What is the highest goal for you? The paramattha. The elder said, why, sire, that this anguish might be stopped and that another suffering may not arise. Our going forth is for this goal, sire, and our highest goal is final nibbana without any grasping. But Reverend Nagasena, do all go forth for such a goal? No, some go forth for such a goal, but others go forth from fear of kings. Some go forth from fear of thieves. Some go forth because they have debts. And some go forth because of the sake of a livelihood. But, sorry?
It's just
read these sentences. Right? Yeah. So, interesting that it says some go forth perhaps by debt, but obviously, if you're in debt, you shouldn't be ordaining, but some of them probably say fibs. It could be, but more likely it's just sort of the reality that, you know, people don't always follow the rules. You know? Mm-hmm. He's just talking about the what actually happens, not necessarily about what should happen. So then he asks, well, did you yourself go forth for this highest goal? And Nagasena says, because I went forth when I was only a boy, sire, I did not know that I was going forth for this goal. But it occurred to me thus, these recluse sons of the Sakyans are learned and will make me train myself. So now that I've been trained by them, I know and see that is going forth is for this goal. So it's quite interesting, isn't it, that he didn't actually go forth to realize Nibbana, but gradually learnt and understood after he'd already ordained. Yeah, he did have a sincerity there. He wasn't doing it for any sincere reason.
The introductory story, he was actually chosen.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that I'm talking
about. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, he was looked after and educated.
Yeah, that's also a part of a kind of standard biography for monks, similar with Moggaliputta, the author of the Katawattu, has a similar kind of thing, so that's part of it.
In fact, I think he was the Bodhisattva somewhere. So
the king answers, you are dexterous, Reverend Nagasena, as it translates here. Next little dialogue is also quite interesting to see the kind of the quite playful interchange between them. The king said, Nagasena, is there anyone after death who's not re-individualized? It translates here as does not reconnect to the Pali term is patisandhati, and patisandhi is the Abhidhamma technical term for the relinking consciousness from one life to the next. So Nagasena replies, some have patisandhi and some do not. In other words, some are reborn and some are not. And who is reborn and who does not? Nagasena says, one who has defilements reconnects, sire. One who is without defilements does not reconnect or is not reborn. Then the king says, will you yourself be reborn or re-individualized? And to which Nagasena says, well, if I have an attachment, sire, an upadana, I will, but if I'm without attachment, I will not be reborn. And he says, very good, Nagasena. So, you know, the king's kind of trying to prompt him into asking, you know, what have you got, you know, what's your attainment? And Nagasena kind of quite skillfully skirts around it. So, this, you know, you really feel, I mean, I really feel in this dialogue that there is this kind of liveliness to it, which has definitely a very personal feel. It's not, if you read the Katawattu by comparison, you know, it's very, very systematic, and it's sort of almost any kind of sense of personality or individuality has been leached out of it. Let's skip over a few more of the questions here. He talks about the characteristics and details of various important sort of doctrinal concepts like concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom, and so on. So they're all quite interesting, but I won't go into them just now. This is another very, very, as a return to the quest for the theme of not self, and another extremely famous, perhaps the most famous quote in the whole book. The king said, he who is reborn, Nagasena, is they the same or are they the other? And to which Nagasena replies, nacha so, nacha anyo. Now, in fact, I should have power to touch here. And remember I said earlier that some of the books included in the Burmese canon and not in the Thai and Sri Lankan, and that's these three here. Okay? The Neti, there was a Neti Pikarana, the Petakopadesa, and the Melinda Panha, the three last ones in the Kudaka Nikaya. So, whoever is Upapajati, is the usual word meaning to be reborn, Vibhante Nagasena, your Upapajati, so eva so udahu anyo, are they the same or the other? And Nagasena is very famous reply, nacha so, nacha anyo di. So this one is quite widely quoted in the Theravadan description or understanding of not self. These particular ideas on the way of treating not self was very bitterly criticized by Venerable Jnanavira, the English monk. So if you want to read a criticism of Nagasena's ideas, then you can have a look at that. Jnanavira tended to be critical of most things. Okay. So he says, should give me a simile, or tell me an illustration. And Nagasena says, what do you think? When you were grown up, are you the same as when you were a boy, young and tender, lying on your back? No, Reverend Sir, that boy, young, tender, lying on his back was one thing. I, who am now fully grown, as another. That being so, Sire, you can have no mother, nor can you have a father, nor can you have a teacher, nor can you be master of a craft, nor can you be one of moral sila, nor can you be one of wisdom. Can it be, Sire, that the mother of the embryo at the first stage in prenatal development is different from the mother at the second stage, and she different from the mother at the third stage, and she different from the mother at the fourth stage? That the mother of the small creature is one thing, the mother of the elder creature is another thing. That one person trains in a craft and another becomes trained, that one does an evil deed and they cut off the hands and feet of another. To which Melinda says, oh no, Reverend Sir. But what would you say, Reverend Sir, when it is spoken thus? The monk replies, it is one self, one I. That was the boy, young, tender, lying on his back, and it is the same I that am now fully grown. And all these are held together as a unity in dependence on this body itself. So it's kind of an interesting way of putting it. Ahanyeva, he says, was one I, Ahanyeva, it was I myself, was one, and Ahanyeva. So, make another simile. It is as if, Sire, some person might light a lamp. Would it burn all night long? Yes, Reverend Sir, it might burn all night long. Is the flame of the first watch the same as the flame of the middle watch? No, Reverend Sir. Is the flame of the middle watch the same as the flame of the third watch? No, Reverend Sir. Is it then, Sire, that the lamp in the first watch was one thing, the lamp in the middle watch another thing, and the lamp in the last watch still another? No, Reverend Sir. It was burning all through the night in dependence on itself. Panyeva Nisaya. Even so, Sire, a continuity of dhammas runs on, dhamma santati. One uprises, another ceases. It runs on as though there were no before, no after. Consequently, neither the one Dhamma nor another is reckoned as the last consciousness. Okay, so there's no ending of consciousness at the ending of the body. So this idea of the Dhamma Santati is a central concept in the translation here on the screen is not very accurate. Okay, it's a continuity of a personal thing maintained. That's not what the text says. The text actually says a Dhamma Santati, a continuity of Dhammas. And so this is the Abhidhamma concept of the sort of the progression of one Dhamma after another, one phenomena after another, being a causal progression of Dhammas rather than a self which provides unity. So there's the text goes on, and there's a discussion of various characteristics of getting reborn and so on, and various characteristics of various qualities, various kinds of dhammas, and the nature of samsara, and various characteristics of different kinds of mental factors. So this is an interesting aspect of the questions. They go through and he defines various kinds of mental factors, intention, consciousness, vitaka, vichara, and so on. But then the king asks an interesting question. Reverend Nagasena, when those conditions... Reverend Nagasena, is it possible, having again and again analyzed those mental states, the nature of which it is to arise together... Okay, so this is the idea in the Abhidhamma that the mental qualities like Vedana, Sanya, intention and so on all arise together. Is it possible to point to a difference between them, saying this is sensory impingement, this is feeling, this is perception, this is volition, this is consciousness, this is applied thought and this is sustained thought? And to which Nagasena replies, it is not possible, sire. And he says, give me a simile. And the monk says, suppose a king's cook were to make a soup or a sauce, or were to throw curds into it, and salt and ginger, and cumin seed, and black pepper, and other ingredients. And it's interesting, giving a bit of an example of how to cook an ancient Indian curry. Not too different, is it? Yeah. And suppose the king should speak thus to me, bring me a sauce of curds, bring me a salt sauce, a ginger sauce, cumin seed sauce, black pepper sauce, bring me a sauce into which everything is being thrown. Now, is it possible, sir, having again and again analyzed these sauces, the nature of which it is to rise together or bring forward a sauce or speak of its acidity or saltiness or bitterness or sharpness or astringency or sweetness? It is not possible to do that, although all of these tastes are present, each with their own distinguishing mark. Even so, sire, it is not possible, having again and again analyzed, to point to the difference between these things, but each is present with its own distinguishing mark. So this is a statement on the nature of wisdom and how we develop wisdom, that you can't actually in reality separate all of the different qualities in the mind. Similar thoughts are found within the suttas themselves, but what we know, the different characteristics of things, and so we can identify the different characteristics of them, even though they're all occurring together. Yeah, of course.
There's one that I read. I don't know how to refer to it, because it's in what's here is called Part 3, Questions for Cutting Off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Four comments. Previous is effort and present endeavor. Mm-hmm. Didn't seem to be particularly profound. It just didn't make sense.
Uh-huh.
It's only a little one.
Can you read the question then?
King Melinda said, you told me, Reverend Sir, that the purpose of your going forth was so that the suffering might cease and another suffering might not arise.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is so. Was it because there had been previous effort? Should one not endeavour at the present time? Present endeavour is concerned with what still remains to be done. Previous effort has accomplished what it had to do. Now that all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a simile that I don't understand. It says, make a simile. What do you think of this, sire? If you were to become thirsty, would you then have a well dug and say, I will drink water? No, revered sir. Even so, sire, present endeavour is concerned with what still remains to be done. Previous effort has accomplished what it had to do. I just don't get it. There's simile here. Yeah, I can understand that. But the conclusion it comes to doesn't seem to relate to the simile.
So here's the text here. Let's have a look at it.
Well, that sort of is a different translation. I think it was just very short, and more extensive as it goes on with the further it was saying.
Yeah.
Actually, it was saying, well, it's a bit too late to dig a well when you're thirsty.
Right.
That's what he meant.
Yeah,
because of the translation, like the wording and the shortness of it. That's not very
wide and kind of clear. No, I agree. It's not entirely clear. Ivy Horner does another translation here, which I think there may be some confusion in the translators as well.
So it doesn't make it.
May well be, yeah.
But they say they use both, but use whatever spirit.
Yeah. I think This one, Rhys Davidson, seems to make more sense. Effort is now concerned with what still remains to be done. Former effort is accomplished what it had to do. Yeah. So same, if you're hungry, would you go and plow
the crops? A bit like the one that you mentioned before, where he said the king.
Preparing for the battle?
Yeah.
Exactly, that's where it is.
Oh, is it the same one?
Yeah, that's where it comes
from. Yeah, right. Okay. Because in this it's just tiny, it's only a few paragraphs, so that's very extensive.
Yeah.
What that should say, that prison ether should always be always be suffering. You should not aim for the war in our future.
Yeah, something like that. It's not entirely clear to me what exactly the purpose, the point of it. Yeah, yeah.
So he's relating it to purpose of your going forth. You're talking about suffering might cease and other thing might not be right. Yeah, I
hear.
It's still there, not there.
Because some of the work I do for the prison suffering, because I'm heartbroken and embraced by the people.
Okay, so we'll have a look at some of the other questions here. So the next one's quite an interesting little one. Nagasena being a bit sceptical here. Melinda being a bit sceptical. The king said, Nagasena, you told me that the fire of Niraya hell was far fiercer than an ordinary fire, that if an ordinary fire was smoking all day, a small stone cast into it would not be dissolved, but if a rock the size of a gabled house had been thrown into the fire in Niraya hell, it would be dissolved in a moment. I do not believe this assertion. And on the other hand, you said that those beings who have arisen in Niraya hell, though boiling there for several thousands of years, are not dissolved. I don't believe this either. So, the question runs here. What do you think about this? Do not female monsters of the deep, sharks and crocodiles and turtles and peacocks and pigeons, eat hard bits of stone and grit? Yes, sir, they do. But then aren't these hard things dissolved when they've entered their stomachs and bellies? Yes, sir, they are dissolved. But is their embryo in the womb also dissolved? No, Reverend Sir. Well, why not? Well, I think, Reverend Sir, that it's through the influence of karma that it is not dissolved. Even so, sire, through the influence of karma that beings in Niraya hell, though boiling for several thousands of years, are not dissolved. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting argument, obviously. And then it goes on, it gives a few other examples, but then here, and there's a similar example about do not the noble women of the delicately nurtured women among the Bactrian Greeks, the Eunuchas, do not they, the nobles, Brahmins and householders, eat hard pieces of cake and meat? Yes, Reverend Sir, they do, but then are these hard things dissolved when they've entered their stomachs and bellies? Yes, but is the embryo in the womb dissolved? Oh, no, Reverend Sir, because of the influence of karma. So there you go. So you can eat hard cookies and dissolve them, but babies aren't dissolved. Anyway, I'll leave that one for you, sir, to examine. Next one is also a little interesting one. Reverend Nagasena, you say this great earth is established on water, water is established on air, and air is established on space. So this being a teaching which is found in the Pali Canon, but and also related to various Upanishadic teachings as well. I don't believe it, says Melinda. Then the elder brought forth water in a, what it says here is a regulation water pot. Okay, the Pali word is Dhammakaraka. Dhamma being translated here as regulation. Can convince King Melinda saying, as this water is supported by the atmosphere, so is that water supported by air. Very good, Nagasena. So it must have been some kind of device. We're not quite sure what it was, but something where the water was somehow held up by air pressure. Yeah, there must have been some kind of device that did that, and I'm not quite sure exactly what it was.
Does it become water?
Yeah, that's right. It must have been something like that, yeah. So showing that the air can be held up, the water can be held up by air.
Hmm.
Right, exactly, yeah. It doesn't prove the argument. But I mean, it is an interesting thing. I mean, it does show that air can be held up by water, but of course, water can be held up by air. Yeah, but it is interesting how this is. It is, you can see how it is a very skeptical and empirical kind of inquiry going on here. And the king is not at all ashamed to say he doesn't believe this or he doesn't believe that. I don't accept this statement. And the kind of references to technology and scientific understanding and so on to prove the point, which in a way is a salutary lesson on the dangers of invoking science to prove that Buddhism is right, because then sooner or later the science usually changes. And once you've tried to prove Buddhism is right by saying it's scientific, then you get into problems. Well, the Pali term is very obscure. It just says Dhammakara, or Dhammakaraka. It's a term found in the Vinaya in a few places. It just says the word for water is not in there. It's because of the usage of it. It's a term that's found a few times in the Vinaya. So it's an idiomatic term that somehow is used to mean a water vessel of some kind.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I'm not familiar with it, but it must have been something like that, yeah. I've never had chickens.
Yeah, well, I've had one. I've had several of them.
Yeah. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's water don't stand there. It does stand in any. It's being kept by water. It's not.
The pressure, yeah.
There's another thing that I use an inverted glass, mm-hmm. like half the water, turn of the wax paper.
It's the pressure
very interesting arguments. It's kind of the it's always with these ones that even then another very striking argument here, quite a well-known one, is the body dear to you recluses, to you ascetics? The body is not dear, but then why, reverend sir, do you treasure and foster it? Nagasena says, but when you've gone into battle, sire, have you been wounded by an arrow from time to time? He says, yes, I have. He said, well, then was not the wound anointed with ointment, smeared with oil, and bandaged with a soft cloth? Yes, reverend sir, it was. But was that wound dear to you, sire, that it was anointed with ointment, smeared with oil, and bandaged with a soft cloth? No, the wound was not dear to me. I just did that so that the flesh might heal. Similarly, sire, the body is not dear to those who have gone forth, but those who have gone forth and without clinging look after the body so as to help towards the holy life. Moreover, sir, the body was likened to a sore by the Lord, and in consequence those who have gone forth and without clinging look after the body as they would a sore. Cleaving, yes, right, yeah. Yeah, it must be an old it's an old English word, yeah. Cleaving to something. It's an older usage, yeah. So another argument. Was the Buddha omniscient? Did he foresee all things? Yes, the Buddha was not only omniscient and he foresaw all things. He was all-seeing. Okay? This, of course, being quite a development from the position in the Pali Canon where the Buddha denies being omniscient. Then, he goes on, how was it, Reverend Nagasena, that he only laid down the training rule for disciples only gradually? Okay? Fair enough question. Yeah. Why didn't he just put it all down at once? So Nagasena's response, is there any physician, any doctor who knows all of the medicines on this earth? And he says, yes, there may be such a man. Well, sire, does that physician make the invalid drink the medicine at the time when he is ill or at the time when he is not ill? He makes the invalid drink the medicine, sire, at the time when he's ill and not at the time when he's not ill. Even so, sire, the Lord, all-knowing and all-seeing, did not lay down the rule of training for disciples at the wrong time, but when the time had come, he laid down a rule of training for disciples not to be transgressed as long as they lived. You are dexterous, Reverend Nagasena. So then some of the arguments are quite serious like that. Some of them are quite very playful. So this one is like, was the Buddha, Nagasena, was he a brahmacharin? Okay? So a follower of the holy life. Yes, he was a brahmacharin. Then Nagasena follows that he was a follower of Brahma. Okay? Nalinda's trying to prove that the Buddha was a Brahma, followed the brahmacharya, therefore he was actually a Brahman. Sire, do you have a state elephant? Reverend, sir, I do have. But now, sire, does that elephant trumpet the heron's cry from time to time? Oh, yes. But is he on that count a pupil of the herons? Well, of course not. Now, tell me, great king, does the Brahma have wisdom? Does he have buddhi or not have buddhi? He has buddhi, Reverend, sir. Well, then, Brahma is a student of the Buddha. So maybe that's probably enough. It's getting 6 o'clock, so probably enough questions of King Melinda. So anyway, hopefully that's given some background and introduction to the one of the most interesting texts in Buddhist literature. So definitely well worth catching up on, and apart from its intrinsic interest, explaining a number of the things in the Dhamma, but as I just mentioned, also giving some good tips on ways of answering difficult questions. Yeah? When we go out there in the world, and especially in the Western world, we find many people who do ask these kinds of knotty questions. So we should always be try to follow Nagasena's example and not feel threatened or anything by the question, but to keep a sense of humour and imagination in our replies. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅgho Sāṅgho.